WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Matlock, Sweet Bird of Youth starring Elizabeth Taylor, Muppets from Space, Anna Karenina, Dexter, Tammy, Bolden, Idlewild, The Crow. What do they have in common? Well, some of them were shot in North Carolina, but not all. Some are period pieces. And some are set in modern times. Some are comedies, some dramas, some are TV productions, some are film. But they all have a look that film set decorator Martha Pino helped to create. On this edition of Coastline, we'll find out what it means to be on the team designing the look and feel of a film. We'll also explore the film community's conversation and self-examination after the most recent fatal shooting on a film set, and we'll hear how her experience on The Crow has shaped her view. The star of that film, Brandon Lee, died nearly 3 decades ago after another actor fired a prop gun at him that contained a live bullet. Martha Pino is also an officer on the board of local IATSE 491, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you, Martha Pino, to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. It's great to be here.
So for those of us who aren't conversant in all the different crew responsibilities that there are on a film set, help us understand what a set decorator does.
I work with right directly under a production designer who actually works very closely with a director and the cinematographer. And I collaborate with the designer and the director and the cinematographer, along with the art director and the art department, to actually craft the look and feel of a script.
So there are a lot of people who participate in creating the look and feel.
That's right.
For a film. Take us through the process, then, of being a set decorator. So you're hired.
Right. Well, the first thing I do is I'll receive a script. I'll read through and I'll break it down, right? Room by room, exterior by exterior, night, day. I'll look at the lighting needs. I'll look at the furnishing needs. And I'll keep in mind what I would possibly bring, all the questions that I would have to bring to the director, to the cinematographer, to my designer, of what is essential to the scene, what does it need? So if I were, say, to work on an interior set, what would the sofa look like? Well, the sofa has to reflect who the character is. So everything that I bring to the table supports the action, the story, supports the actor, the collaboration there, and it all works as one thing to suspend disbelief, essentially, to create a drama that is believable. Yeah.
One of the films that we're going to talk in depth about today is Idlewild. You were the set decorator on that film. How many different scenes do you have to create? I know each production probably varies quite a bit, but is there sort of a ballpark number? How much work is it in the beginning before production really starts?
Well, going back to the breakdown, I can't say that there's an average. I know that, a feature film is on average 120 script pages. That seems to be a basic, and there could be anywhere from 24 locations, say, for example, on The Black Phone. I recall that's a production that I finished up this year. there might have been 24-ish locations to Idlewild, which may have been 40 to 50. It's been a while, but I haven't broken it down recently, but it varies. It can be 45, 75. It depends on where the story takes you.
Set decorators are a less visible part in terms of the public eye of film production. Do set decorators receive Academy Awards? I mean, is that a job that is recognized within the film community itself?
Yes. Yes, they do. We can receive Academy Awards for the design, the look of the show. The production designer and the set decorator share that credit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I, growing up as a little girl, never imagined becoming a set decorator on film. I didn't even know what that was. I didn't know they existed, and I'm sure there are a lot of people that are in the same boat. You were living in Santa Barbara, and this was early on in your adult life, and you were afraid that you were going to turn into a crystal-reading hippie. But tell us first, this was before you started, really, your professional life as a set decorator. What was formative about your time there, and how did it feed your next steps?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of truth in that, right? And we could go down that storyline. But in a nutshell, yes, I had just finished up my studies at the Universidad de Guadalajara in Mexico. And I received a grant to actually study fine art, literature, and sculpture, painting, that sort of thing, in Mexico. My time in Mexico finished up, and I ended up in Santa Barbara through friends. And I studied fine art and theater. And even though I knew in my heart of hearts that I would never be able to make a living as an artist or a costume designer in theater, that there was just something else I needed to do in my life. And of course, I would see films. Sometimes I would go to AFI. There was a chapter of AFI in Santa Barbara, and I was always inspired. Like film, I think film is part of is baked into the American culture, right? It was the same for me. I've always loved films, and there was this feeling that how was I going to get on with my life? And I think that when you're in your 20s, I think this is an overarching question. You're just becoming your adult self, and you're full of the angst of these questions of where you want to go with your life. And so I had these questions. And I decided to actually voluntarily get myself out of Santa Barbara because I was afraid that I would become just a crystal reading hippie living along the coast along with my surfer friends, which was pretty, you know, it's pretty great at the time, I have to say. It was hard to leave all of that behind me, but I just knew that I needed to get on with my life, even though I didn't know what that was. And so I landed in Los Angeles and met with a group of friends who were set decorators in the film industry. And that pretty much launched my own career.
And do you remember your first job?
I do. It was to live and die in L.A. I was brought on by some extraordinary women who became my mentors. And they were at the top of their game at the time, and I just absorbed all of the information that I could at the time. And this was during the 80s, and I found myself just going through the studio system of Hollywood, where you work at all of the studios, whether it's Warner Brothers or Universal or Paramount. And I learned the trade.
Cricket Rowland?
Cricket Rowland was a big mentor of mine.
Yes. So yes, set to right. decorator on
yes,
To Live and Die in
right.
L.A. When you think today, when you get hired for a film today and you hear Cricket Rowland's voice in your head, what kinds of things does she say? What are some of the elements of your approach today that she shaped?
Well, the other day I was trying to explain it to you, and there's, people, when you try to describe a personality and you are really drawn to them and you learn from them, there's this ineffable spirit in them, first of all, that's indescribable. And one, I just wonder what am I drawn to? But there was just not only this ease, but this this generous spirit, this this way of describing things that I just wanted to know, what is she talking about? This just sounds like the best idea. She's pointing me in the right direction. And I was just eager to go after. She would give me a laundry list of things for me to go, going to the design center, the Blue Whale in Los Angeles, and meeting all of those vendors and picking out the perfect, delicious persimmon mango-colored velvet for this sofa for some living room that we were doing. She just had this spirit of quality that I just adored and fell in love with and was eager to learn under.
You're listening to Coastline. Film set decorator Martha Pino is my guest today. After this short break, we'll find out about her experience on The Crow, how that shaped the conversation she believes the film community needs to have. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Stay with us. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. If you've seen the films Bolden or Idlewild or the 1989 Elizabeth Taylor film Sweet Bird of Youth or Anna Karenina, you've experienced that story and entered that world in part thanks to the creativity of set decorator Martha Pino. She is my guest today. And if you've never seen Idlewild, you can catch a free screening of it on Sunday, November 14th at the Point 14 in Wilmington. It's part of the North Carolina Filmmakers Series. After the film, Martha Pino will participate in a Q&A. Martha, you've said that you are especially proud of the period pieces that you've worked on, like Bolden, Anna Karenina, Sweet Bird of Youth. What's different about working on a period piece?
Well, it's the history, right? One has to dig so much deeper to create something that's authentic, right? You take a kitchen, for example, and it doesn't matter if it's from Mercy Street or Harriet or the Good Lord Bird. This is all pre-Civil War America, you know, where you require a wood-burning stove, or if you're in a mid-century modern kitchen and you need, a brand-new refrigerator from 1960, well, you know, to know the manufacturer's name, you know, to know if it had push-button panels as opposed to non-push-button panels, because that indicates a break in 1960. So the correctness of the look is very important. But you dig deeper because all of that is married to the culture and to the zeitgeist of the time, right? And I really love all of that. I can't have enough research time ahead of a production shoot to find out everything that I need to know. But I really love that more than anything else. And that is brought to the table.
So it combines, you already have a pretty healthy working knowledge of certain elements of history,
that's right,
literature, fine arts, but you still have to research.
That's right.
So what happens when you encounter an era or a corner of the world that you don't know very much about? How do you conduct that research?
Well, of course, nowadays the internet, and there's many reasons for that, because it's there and it's quicker, and one doesn't have pre-production time in order to really dig in and do the research. You and I talked about a time when pre-internet, you know, I still have rooms in my house of bookcases from floor to ceiling of all research books, right? And in the old days, we would hire a research firm to go to the library, and then we would also send our art department PA, our production assistant, to the public library to do the research for us. But nowadays, you can Google anything, and you can pretty much get the information at your fingertips. But I have a resource library of internet search sites, as well as the, you know, my collection of library books, and everything is interchangeable depending on how much time you have, you know.
You, as set decorator, you've said that on a Civil War film, for example, you need to understand the importance of railroads. How does that inform what you wind up doing as a set decorator in an example like that?
Well, railroads was such an important element of American history, right? It was modern technology at the time, right? You would have towns that ran around along the railroad lines. You have goods and services. You would have the telegraph and telecommunications. You would have it's the way that people communicated during the time. And understanding that is very important, because not only, for example, I would often have to dress a railroad station. I would often have to dress the entire interior of a passenger railway car. Well, which railway car? Is it first class? Is it second class? Is it a cattle car? Is it a mail compartment? All of those things, you know, have specific needs.
And so a different department has actually built the car. So let's say in this case that it's a first class compartment. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things, then, do you have to put inside that car?
Well, on Harriet and even on Anna Karenina, we built the railway cars. And then, of course, we had the special effects, you know, and oftentimes the reproduction of a railway car, the engine and the cars. But in this specific case, when we design the interior of the cars, then I, of course, upholster and fabricate the seating. And that has a look and feel. It has a certain shape. Then there are the window treatments. There's the lighting. Say, for example, during the time of Harriet, there would be kerosene lighting. So one time I went on this vast road trip to try to find period-correct railway lighting, but you could only find one of a kind, right? So we would actually manufacture a gimbal whereby the bracket would be installed, and it would allow the oil lamp to swivel at every turn and the jostling of the rail cart on the tracks. And there would be this whole discussion about whether it should be real oil or electrical. And so on and so forth. And you have the luggage and this and all, racks and all of that. So everything is fabricated. Yeah.
Now, on Anna Karenina, one of your jobs was to finish the carriages, the carriage blankets. How did you learn about carriage blankets?
You know, this was at a time, I believe it was pre-internet, pre-wireless. So I would turn to the museums. You would find myself at the Hermitage every other weekend doing vast amounts of research. And I looked at paintings of the time. That's where my art history, my love for art history comes in, because a lot of my research is through art. So you would see the carriage blankets on the sleighs, and I remember, you know, in Petersburg going to a marketplace where I actually bought the furs and imported a lot of my silk tapestries from England, and had all of the carriage blankets made up for the sleighs. It's an extraordinary experience.
You're listening to Coastline. Martha Pineau is my guest today. She's a film set decorator known for helping to create the look and feel of Sweet Bird of Youth, The Crow, Dexter the Pilot, Anna Karenina, and Idlewild, among many others. She's also an officer on the board of local IATSE 491. Now, you did work on The Crow, and you've said that this was a film because it was from a comic book series.
That's right.
It required you creating the entire look, the entire set from the ground up. Talk about that.
Yes, well, it was an amazing experience, right? It was a time when the Superman films were a huge franchise. Marvel, productions of Marvel comic books were just starting to come out. And Alex Proyas, the Australian director, came to Wilmington to create this underground comic strip that was written out of Chicago. And so this would be the alternative to a Marvel, right? And it was exciting from that point of view. It was much darker, much grittier, and we did indeed create the entire world of The Crow. And it was also before computer-generated graphics. So there was still an incredible amount of model making. For example, we created the, not myself, but those model makers created this whole world of miniature where you see the fly, the crow flying across the city, that sort of thing.
Wow. What do you remember about the day that Brandon Lee was shot?
Mm. Well, I wasn't. I can say that I wasn't on set. I had gone home after working a very, very long day. I work the morning day shift. But sometimes my work will extend late into the evening, because that film shoot was predominantly at night. So I heard the next day of the incident.
And at this point, he would have been in the hospital.
That's right. That's right. The production was basically shut down. I remember the investigations by the FBI. It was a very serious time. It was a very dark time for all of us. Very regrettable, very tragic.
Now that it's 28 years later, mm-hmm. almost 30 years later, what do you think about that tragedy today? Has your thinking about that tragedy changed? I mean, you mentioned that in 1993, CGI didn't exist, mm-hmm. so that wasn't an option. And we'll get to Rust in a moment. But
yeah.
But first, how has your thinking about that and your feeling about that tragedy changed over the years? If at all?
Well, we think about it a lot, because accidents and then fatal accidents still happen. And despite the safety protocols that are in place, despite the training courses, I still think that sometimes I think that it's amazing that films ever get made because of the relentless scheduling.
Is that part of the safety issue?
I think so. This has been cited in various articles that have come out over Rust. It is something that's hard to articulate because this tragedy still remains somewhat of a mystery, and we try to do better. We implement the training, the safety, but obviously it's still not enough, you know. So where do we take it now?
Your union, IATSE, is talking about requiring gun safety training for, what is it, all crew, all members of the union
discussion. It's being discussed now, and I'm all for it. There are quite a few mandatory safety programs that one has to go through. And I think that this is something else that is going to take form. I have yet to hear from the producers. I guess, you know, we would feel a sense of relief if there was a de facto ruling on it, and yet there still isn't. Yes, you know, of course I'm already talking about Rust, but...
A de facto ruling on...
On gun safety.
You mean requiring...
Training courses for the actors, say.
Right.
Doubling down on safety.
You referred to a piece that was published in Variety by Shannon Lee, the sister of Lee.
That's right.
And she asks these questions. Could we require actors to receive mandatory gun safety training before handling a gun on a film set so they can have some sovereignty over their safety and the safety of those they're pointing a firearm at? She asks, could the person in charge of safety on a film set not be the same person in charge of making sure the production runs on time and on budget, so there are no conflicts of interest or cutting of corners? And she also asks, could a seasoned and competent gun safety specialist be required to be on set anytime a real firearm is being used, even just for one setup? I've heard so many people ask, why we're even talking about this in 2021 with CGI? Why do we have to have real guns on set? Why do we have to have live ammunition on set? Do you see an argument for that? Do you understand why there's resistance to just requiring that those sorts of things become computer-generated imagery?
Well, I think she also mentioned in the piece it has something to do, the resistance comes from, well, an actor needs that real gut reaction working with a real firearms. Well, you did get used to, and her response was you got used to working with green screens where you're flying across, you know, a mountaintop or whatever. So there is some adopting and to be done. I just don't see the point of using live fire. That's my point of view only. And I am more than eager and willing to listen to what direction who's going to head up these discussions? How are we going to resolve this? And to date, I felt like Shannon Lee's article was the most succinct. She's asking all the right questions.
As an officer of local IATSE 491, we've all heard, you know, it's a national story that IATSE members were ready to strike.
That's right.
There is a contract on the table. Where is that now? And how are you feeling? How are members feeling about signing that contract?
Well, it does. The strike authorization and the fact that we have been working without a contract, I think it was since September, you know, the fatal shooting on the set of Rust in New Mexico has coincided with this need, this dire need for producers to come back to the table to talk, to build in safety, turnaround times, which is, it's all about sleep and being with family, right? Our membership across the nation will be ratifying this contract. They will be asked to ratify, vote yes or no. And I really can't say where it's going to go.
There's a change.
I cannot, this Rust incident has come at a perfect moment to point out the flaws in the industry, essentially.
You're listening to Coastline. Martha Pineau, film set decorator, is my guest today. When we come back from this short break, we'll find out what she would say to her younger self and those up-and-coming film professionals in the region. We'll also find out how she deals with conflicts over creative vision. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're exploring the world of filmmaking through the eyes of the set decorator. Martha Pineau got her big break on the 1989 film Sweet Bird of Youth, starring Elizabeth Taylor. Since then, she's helped to create the worlds of The Crow, Anna Karenina, the pilot for the TV series Dexter, Bolden, and Idlewild. However, that's not even close to an exhaustive list. And if you've never seen Idlewild, you can catch a free screening of it on Sunday, November 14th at the Point 14 in Wilmington. It's part of the North Carolina Filmmaker Series. After the film, Martha Pineau will participate in a Q&A. So let's talk about Idlewild for a moment. What was your first impression of the concept of Idlewild?
Well, it just blew me away. I was asked to do this period piece, 1930s, Prohibition in the South, and I said, great, I love that time period. Love the stories about Prohibition. It's wild times, right? It's just crazy times in America. But then what the director is bringing Outcast, you know, and there will be this musical element using hip hop, and it really, quite honestly, it blew me out of the water and knocked my socks off all at once. And
You didn't think it was possible.
I had no idea. It was so fresh and new that I didn't see how that could, those two elements could possibly marry.
Rappers, jazz, Prohibition,
hip hop. Yes. Yeah.
And so then how did you approach it? So you took the job. How did you set about characterizing the look and feel you needed to create for Idlewild?
Well, like I always start with my history, right? Prohibition, small town, southern Georgia, right? Idlewild, Georgia. It's a fantastical place, but still, you start with the bones of the architecture. You start with the, you know, you're inspired by the moss-covered trees and bootlegging. What's that all about? You know, how does one pack and crate moonshine, that sort of thing? So you start with the history, definitely. And I think the director was always pretty true, as a baseline, true to the history. But then there was definitely a jumping off point with the speakeasy, where it was just transformed into a different world. We had, like, for example, the morgue in the basement of this mortuary, the family mortuary, Percival's father's family business, was all very real. We found mortuary equipment from the era, from the 1920s, brought it all aboard. We built the set, dressed it. But then you get to the speakeasy, which was another world altogether.
There's a piano that's almost an important character in this film.
That's right.
This was a 1930s player piano?
No, the player piano was for Lolita, and we'll talk about that story because it's sort of related in that it's how I bring and find the period pieces to any set, right? It's through my vast connection of resources that I've built up for the 25 years that I've been living in the South. But the piano, of course, is a key prop. And you say, okay, well, what's the difference between a prop and a piece for set decorating? Well, the piano is something that the set decorator finds. And I found it through a family piano company somewhere in western North Carolina. And it was Percival's piano. And it was actually a very exciting action-adventure piece for that film. And I don't know if you want us to talk about that now.
Well, I don't think we're worried about spoilers here because
right,
the film's been out for
right,
quite a few years now.
That's
so.
Right.
It's a really engaging film, a lot of fun to watch.
Oh my, yeah.
And the piano has to die.
The piano has to die.
So did you kill an antique 1930s upright?
With music magic, no, we did not. The piano was replicated, fabricated by our special effects department. So it was much lighter in weight. Don't ask me how they replicated the keys. But in the sort of the arch of the climax, part of the dramatic climax of the show is that the piano goes crashing across the stage, right? And that's Percival's piano. And I think that there's this whole symbolism connected with Percival. He's coming out of his shell, and maybe that's his breakthrough, I don't know, but
the shattering of the status quo.
Yes, something along those lines. There are many levels, right, which the piano operates, and I was all too pleased to be part of that.
So there's
very exciting.
There's a player piano in Lolita then.
That's right.
Is this also 1930s?
We'd have to go back to the novel. I think that was more 50s, I believe. 40s,
okay.
50s, right?
Still considered an antique?
Yes. That's right. I don't know. I don't remember the manufacturer of the Baby Grand, and I think I'd have to look that up because it was just a gorgeous piece, and it was also required to be a player piano, and that's when I met the Klutz piano. I discovered it through road trips. And back then it was, you didn't have GPS, you just had road maps, and you would make calls from your oversized mobile phone and track things down. So everything was cold calling. And I found this piano company that had an extraordinary collection of pianos from close to 150 years of collections of early 19th century pianos to beautiful grand pianos to upright pianos, player pianos, you name it. It's just an extraordinary collection. So I found that the Baby Grand was featured when Quilty was dying and getting shot, blood all over the keys. We had to repair the period ivory keys. I'm not sure how they were cleaned, but that was very dramatic. So maybe my connection is with pianos, the drama of pianos. That could be a leitmotif of my...
It could. So you're known...
my resume.
...for blowing apart pianos in one way or another. But this family-owned company, this collection of pianos that you found, this is in Western North Carolina?
That's right. Yes.
And how did you find them?
Literally by cold calling. When there is something that is written into a script and it's a key thing, back to my training again, right? You break down a script and you highlight those things that are going to be the hardest thing in the entire script to find or to fabricate, and you go after it first. And not finding it is simply not an option.
In Idlewild, you mentioned the moss-covered trees, mm-hmm. and that there is one scene when an intense rainstorm breaks out, and so much of what you see in these shots are the Spanish moss swinging in the wind and the rain. It's almost like it's got its own personality. The cuckoo clocks.
Oh, yeah.
There's a wall of cuckoo clocks that that's part of one of the devices that moves the film storytelling along. When all of the cuckoo clocks, I don't know what the verb is, cuckoo at the same time? Cook? So, where did you find all those cuckoo clocks? Were those created? For
we,
the film?
We create, we purchase them here, there, everywhere, right? And by the way, I just adored that scene. It was tender and tragic and fantastical and lyrical, right? And then the cuckoo clocks, right? You just think, well, how could that ever be part of something so fantastic, but it worked, and that's the genius of Brian Barber. So, yes, we source cuckoo clocks from all over, and they were sent over to special effects to rig them to work with, and were synchronized with the music. Is that's movie magic, yes?
Yeah. So when you look back on your career... And, you know, we all have those moments when we think, oh, I wish I knew then what I know now. What if you could have a magic moment of going back to your younger self and saying, hey, I want to give you some advice. You really should know this. What would that be?
You asked that question to me, and I haven't given another thought. It's not because I don't have anything to say about it, because I don't know where to begin to discuss such a question, because it's really important for any individual who is, you know, exploring a creative their creative life to find their voice, right? I did not know at the time when I was going through and studying film, you know, working in film and working through the studio system, what a foundation that gave me, Right. Because now here that I'm settled in Wilmington, there are no prop houses. So I travel extensively, and my resources run from west of the Mississippi all the way up through New York and now Canada, right? You know, you need to trust that your experiences will become embodied in who you are, and no one can ever take that away from you, and it builds. It's like muscle memory, you know. You know, and for one to know and understand that, of course, if I knew that, then, you know, who knows where I would be now. But I think that's a key thing to understand.
And we have just a few minutes left, but this happens so often in any kind of creative situation, certainly not just on film sets or television productions. But creative people come together, they have different jobs. What happens when you have a different artistic vision from the one of the department that's next to you? How do you resolve conflict when you're saying, no, there has to be Spanish moss in the foreground of the shot because it's an important part of this scene? And say the prop department or somebody else in the art department says, we can't have any Spanish moss in this scene. How do you resolve that?
Well, that would be the greens department. That would be the easy way of solving it. We would say that that's someone else's department. But that happens in our world too, right?
You know, it's that like might be the key to life right there. It's someone else's department.
Call greens and not the set deck department. But no, you know, look, at these questions come up all the time. And happily, through experience, one's experience and tenacity and the things that you have up your sleeve, you sit down and you figure it out. You solve the problem. That is what drives us as professionals and creatives. Say, what do you need? How can we help you? How can we solve the problem? How can we make this happen? And we solve the problem every time. We solve it.
The show must go on.
Yes, yes. And you solve it professionally to try to make it happen. You know, if it works for the story, for the character, if it works conceptually, then yes, on with the show.
Your garden is a big part of your life, and it's how you sort of refill the reservoir after
yes.
you've worked hard on a film production. What is going to happen with your garden this winter?
Well, I've started the cleanup, right? I had mentioned to all my friends that I feel like my garden after a tough summer of work. I feel just as tattered as the banana trees and the vines that are just kind of swinging in the wind. And so big cleanup, right? And it's a cleanup, a good fresh start to body and spirit. And going to watch the paper whites come up for Christmas and enjoy their fragrance and watch the camellias bloom.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Martha Pineau, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been such a pleasure spending time with you. Thank
Likewise.
You.
And thanks to the North Carolina Filmmaker Series. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Jonathan Furnell engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, find it at whqr.org or just get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.